The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think. And many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dawe. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dawe. We're happy today to have Enrique Fiallo with us. And the reason why we're so excited to talk with Enrique is of his background. He was born in Cuba, came to the U.S. with very little, but the things that he was carrying with him. And then he moved on, went to college, and was the first in his family to go to university, and went on from there into a business career that resulted in him being the CEO of a company that he took public on the New York Stock Exchange and actually rang the bell on its first day of trading, which for many people is kind of the pinnacle of a successful business career. And then some things went on after that we're going to talk about today. And so, Enrique, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be with both of you.
Enrique, your background is so interesting. You're kind of a classic, American success story in that, you were born in Cuba and immigrated here and reached the top of the business world. But why don't you start with Cuba and tell us kind of your early life in Cuba?
Okay, so it's going to be a little difficult to share a lot of detail because I was 6 years old when we emigrated to the United States. But I can tell you that after a lot of conversations with my mother after we got here, I started to put together the pieces as to why she thought it was the best thing to do. I have a picture of her and her two brothers sitting around the dining room table in Cuba. The third brother is the one that took the picture. And what she was telling me is that was the night that they mutually decided that the best path for her and her two boys, a widow with a grandmother, my grandmother that lived with us as well, was to go to the United States. She had a feeling, and her brothers did too, that things were not going to go well in Cuba. So in June of 1958, she actually had preceded us here. She was here for about 6 months or so before we got here. We got on a plane and with nothing but what we were wearing, came to the United States. And sure enough, 6 months later in December, New Year's Eve, as a matter of fact, Fidel Castro came down from the mountains and overran the city, and Fulgencio Batista fled, and the rest is history. And so she was very, very, her gut told her something wasn't right. And, decided let's make the big move. And so it was a big move for us, and we never looked back.
Did you many of your family, you mentioned that her brother, grandmother, was your kind of entire immediate family as you knew it able to come, or were there people left behind?
There were some people left behind. So one uncle, one of her brothers, was here. Two of them stayed back in Cuba because they had family ties and couldn't really break those very easily. But my grandmother's nine brothers and sisters were all in the United States. So we had a very large family. I had lots of cousins and second cousins and aunts and uncles here in the United States that welcomed us and obviously weren't in a position to give us a tremendous amount of help because they were all struggling too. But we had a very strong core family here in the United States, but we did leave some folks behind.
And then you got here, you're 6 years old, which probably you're pretty much then into school age, and you go to school, and And did you go to Miami? Is that where you started?
Yes, we started in Miami.
And what was that like then, you know, growing up? Did you immediately, was English a factor? You kind of got into the community and kind of went from there? Or do you remember much in the way of adjusting?
It was quite an adjustment. And I'll tell you, I have never forgotten my first and second grade teacher, same teacher I had in both first and second grade, Mrs. Seidner, who later became Miss Seidner, who later became Mrs. Cohen. She took me under her wing. She asked my mother's broken English. She said to my mother, I would like to keep Enrique after school for about an hour every day and teach him English, because I spoke literally no English. And let me tell you, I thank that lady even to this day. I've never forgotten her, never forgotten her name, because she took me under her wing, taught me English, and I flourished. You know, for example, in elementary school, I won every spelling bee from grades 1 through 6 as a result of the tutorship of Ms. Seidner, later Mrs. Cohen.
Wow, that's a great story. So then as you got into your school years, then you know, did you have an idea as to what you wanted to do as you went into high school and then on to college, or was that something that was still yet to be determined?
Well, that's an interesting story, because I wanted to be a musician, and my mother had remarried when I was 12 to a wonderful guy who I consider to be my father. I learned so many lessons from this man who only had a 6th grade education, but he was probably the strongest leader I have ever seen in my entire life, and he taught me a lot of valuable life lessons. I wanted to be a musician. He wanted me to be an accountant. So when I graduated from high school, number 13 in my class of 1,000, by the way, I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that I skated through high school and I could have done a lot better, but I ended up going to a community college, enrolling in the accounting curriculum, flunked every single accounting class I took. And I said, this is not for me. So I switched to an English major, because music by then had become a non-starter for me. He just wouldn't have it. He said, you're not going to be able to build a career as a musician. And I don't know that he was wrong about that, because how many people struggle in the music industry? So I switched majors to English. I petitioned the Student Senate and the Faculty Senate to remove all my flunking accounting grades, which they did, because it was obvious I wasn't even showing up for class. And I ended up switching majors to English. I thought I was going to be an English teacher. And when I graduated from community college, I decided, no, this is not for me either. So I went into the business world, you know, blue collar type work, working for the telephone company. And then later on went back to college to get my bachelor's degree and then eventually my master's degree. So at first I really didn't know what I was doing or where I was going, like a lot of people, like a lot of young people, right? But then I sorted it out and I realized that, hey, this business world and technology especially, because I was drawn to the technology field, really appealed to me. And so that's where my career path went.
And Enrique, I mean, it's quite a big decisions there. First of all, you talk about the steadfast support you had from your father in Miami and making that decision. But then you talk about that kind of immediacy that it didn't fit, you know, the accounting world. I guess, you know, for us listening and for listeners, what can we take from that about Enrique, even in those early days?
I think that the fact that my parents gave me the opportunity to work my way through what I really wanted to do, and I was able to understand. I wish I hadn't flunked, you know, 10 courses, but, you know, it was a learning experience. And I think that at a very young age, sometimes it's very difficult for people to figure out what they're going to do. So they really need an opportunity to be able to try things out and to see what works, what doesn't work, what their affinity is, what they're drawn to. And then once you do that, to just go for it just as strongly as you can and as passionately as you can.
Okay, got it.
Did you see then, so you decide you're drawn to technology, you go into that, and tell us what happened then.
Well, so this is an interesting story because I was a telephone installer repairman. I went to pole climbing school, and I actually graduated from pole climbing school and ended up working for the telephone company. I'd take my van every morning with a bunch of service orders in hand and install telephones and install technology products. And I learned we got the opportunity to upsell the customers on custom calling features and things like that. And the average installer repairman would sell about 35 points or so of those every month. Once I realized what that opportunity was, my first month I sold 180 points. I blew away all the records. The next month I sold 215 points. I even remember the number of points to this day. That got somebody's attention and said, hey, this guy really understands technology and how to sell it. So I was given an opportunity to move into the marketing department in technology and became a communication consultant. So I went through the entire AT&T curriculum and I really flourished because I was passionate about it, because I loved technology and how technology could make people's lives easier, better, provide value to businesses. And so that was a spark that ignited my career for the next 20 or 30 years.
And what got you attracted to that? Was that something, you know, as a child, whatever, you know, in the technology world, you know, liking electrical things, you know, what actually got you in to enjoy that, really?
Yeah, it was actually the fact that these were solutions that had a technical underpinning, right? The electrical circuitry, the solution itself that was an integration of components. I was fascinated, for example, how my first phonograph that my father bought me, he started to buy me Beatles albums because that was his concession to forcing me out of music, was to start me on the Beatles collections. But how that phonograph worked and how the telephone worked, and you know, I started reading about Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Alva Edison and Samuel Morse and all these inventors, and that really sparked my interest. And what I thought was, well, here's a bunch of wires and components and circuitry, transistors and things that provide an integrated solution that brings value to people. So I think that's what sparked my interest.
Wow. So, you know, that's an interesting thing. I got to tell you, you're the first person that we've talked to that's gone to telephone pole climbing school. So, you know, and the weird thing is I've always wanted to figure out how to do that. It looks like it would be fun.
Well, it's fun until you burn a pole. Let me tell you what burning a pole is. You're all the way at the top with your spikes on and you're dug in. The thing you're told is to never get close to the pole unless you've got your arms around it. I got close to the pole, down I went, creosote and splinters, you know, in my arms and legs. So, but it is fun, you know, the feeling of being able to climb up a pole and look out over the city and do your work, you know, suspended until your feet fall asleep. It was an experience, and I'm glad that I went through it, but I knew that it wasn't going to be something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah, no doubt. So, that, you know, it's interesting. So you make that transition really from kind of the trade side of it, you know, being an installer to selling, then you go into marketing, and then what happens?
So then things took off from there. So AT&T was going through a transformation. You'll recall the ruling of AT&T having to divest their businesses, and then AT&T forming a subsidiary that basically was totally free to compete, and they even got into computers. Well, I had the opportunity to transfer into that entity, and they put me through weeks and weeks of training. They actually put me through 10 weeks of training, 2 weeks at a time, up at MIT to teach me and a couple of thousand others computer science. We actually went through a curriculum taught by MIT professors to give us a background in computer science so we would be prepared to sell, service, and support computer solutions to customers. I graduated from that curriculum. Every single class I was in, I graduated number one. And the professors asked me to come back and to teach, become part of their staff, still working for AT&T, to teach that curriculum to others. I did that. It was a fantastic experience because I was the dumbest person in the room for a number of years while I was on that staff. Obviously, I grew a lot, but these people were brilliant. I mean, the two professors were world-renowned. They had published I don't know how many books. They were tenured professors at MIT. They had side businesses going. And so that then moved me into the computer field, not just now telecommunications, but also computing and how computing related to telecommunications. And more importantly, how you put together computer pieces as part of an overall solution to solve customer problems.
So back in solutions then. So then you do that, and then how do you end up going from there basically to CEO of a public company?
Okay, so what happened there is eventually I left AT&T because I got an opportunity to work on the customer side of things, and I went to work for a very large company. Well, I had a stint at Price Waterhouse. They hired me as a telecommunication consultant for a couple of years. And I knew that at the age that I joined Price Waterhouse that I wasn't going to become a partner. I mean, you're either partner track or you're not. And so eventually I went to work for a customer of Price Waterhouse. It's not Price Waterhouse now. Some people that listen to this probably don't even recognize that because it's Price Waterhouse Coopers. And so I went to work for a customer of theirs, Ryder Integrated Logistics. I ended up in Ryder Integrated Logistics. And I went through the ranks, manager of telecom, director of telecom, director of computer services, to the first Hispanic vice president in the history of Ryder. And I became the vice president in charge of the integrated logistics solutions. So Ryder would sell logistics solutions to customers. And a big part of that solution was the technology piece, logistics routing and scheduling, packaging, how to load a truck using technology solutions, how to manage a warehouse with a warehouse management system, that kind of thing. So I became a vice president in charge of that piece, the technology piece. Then I guess I got the attention of recruiters. They just wouldn't stop calling. And I ended up interviewing for a position at Entergy, which is the public utility that has Louisiana, parts of Texas, Mississippi, and Arkansas. Big $11 billion company. And they hired me as a vice president of information technology. Long story short, I became CIO at Entergy. That's the culmination of the technology career. That's the pinnacle of the technology career, the chief information officer role. And it was a great, great job. The only problem was at the time I was married to a lady and we had two young daughters and she hated New Orleans. New Orleans is a tough social place to break into. And so she just didn't like it. And so I ended up getting recruited to a company in the Northeast, Cabletron Systems, which was a competitor of Cisco's. It was a $1 billion company, paling. And at first it was larger than Cisco, but obviously Cisco overtook them. But they were competitive in the switching and routing space, switchers, routers, local area networks, that kind of thing. And shortly after I joined them as chief information officer, again, to make a long story short, the chairman who hired me decided to retire and take the company, split it into four subsidiaries, and then spin them off. And so here I was, I went home. The guy that he handed the reins over to had come in an acquisition, an Indian fellow, very, very talented. I mean, wickedly smart from a technology perspective, but he and I just didn't see eye to eye, you know, in terms of leadership and management. His style wasn't really my style. And I thought, okay, Fialo, you're out of a job. Start looking because the hammer's going to fall. Well, guess what? That same night that I was thinking that, I get a phone call from him And he starts laying these accolades on me, and he goes, you know, we're splitting the company up into four pieces. One of the pieces is going to focus on the enterprise market segment, which means large Fortune 1000 companies. He says, I want you to become president of that subsidiary, and I want you to take it, spin it off, and become CEO, chairman, and president of that spinoff. I was blown away because now I go from CIO to president of subsidiary, and then eventually to spin it off to be CEO of a publicly traded company. How many people get an opportunity to do that, coming from Cuba in 1958 and going through all the things that I went through? And so that's how I went from a telephone installer repairman climbing poles all the way to becoming the CEO of a publicly traded company.
So how did you get to the point that you described then? And that's a big access point, isn't it? About you picking up the phone or seeing this gentleman in the morning and telling him where you felt you were, to that sudden access point of coming back. I mean, what do we as listeners have to take from that? You know, was it about you being patient once in your life or reflecting on it long? You know, what things do you take from that? You know, there must have been a great learning.
Well, there was. And I think part of what impressed him was that his sales and marketing executives were taking me on customer visits as CIO, and they soon discovered that I had an affinity with these people who were the purchasers, buyers of technology solutions and network solutions. I could speak their language, talk their talk. I guess the lesson from that is that opportunities are often presented to you disguised as something else. And so you really need to look at the things that you're doing and to see where the opportunities are inside those things. And so that word got back to him. He actually saw me in action on a couple of those sales calls. I guess it impressed him. And even though I had no experience, and by the way, this is the bad side of what happened to me, the fact that I had no experience, he thought, well, I will mentor him, I will guide him, and I will coach him. And so you just never know. You know, you might be at odds with somebody or think you're at odds with somebody. And in fact, what you've done is you've impressed them because you've been honest and straightforward and transparent while being respectful. And I think that's what got their attention. And so the lesson that I learned from that was you have to be aware of what you're doing at all times because you never know where the opportunity lies.
Yeah, fascinating.
That's a great point. So then if you're the guy that back on climbing the, you know, the telephone pole, did you, if you were able to look out climbing the top of the telephone pole, looking around at the world, did you see yourself reaching that point that you came to, you know, just a few short years later?
No, definitely not. I mean, I, you know, at that point, that was the 1970s. Life was a lot simpler back then, at least now it seems like it was. And I was just kind of living day to day. And I hadn't yet formulated some of the philosophies and some of the principles that were later to serve me. The way that I did that was by paying attention to some role models. I worked for a guy once I got out of the pole climbing thing. I worked for a guy who became a top executive at AT&T. And I wish I had him to mentor me while I was in the CEO phase of my career, because he taught me a lot of valuable lessons. One of the things he taught me, and I will tell you that it has stayed with me to this day, because back then at the top of that pole, I was one of the most impatient people you'd ever want to meet. And what he said to me is, listen, you've got to be able to be more patient than you are. He says, you're a perfectionist and you're a driver. And you expect a lot of yourself, and therefore you expect a lot from other people. And you have to understand, this is the way he said it, almost word for word. He said, the majority of people that you run across, you personally run across, are going to disappoint you because they don't have the same drive, initiative, attention to detail, attention to quality that you have. You just got to focus on where they are, help them to improve where they can, but be patient and tolerant, because rarely are you going to be able to have the luxury of fielding a team of all A1 world-class people. You don't have the time. You're not going to have the budget. So you've got to figure out how to get things done with the people that you have. Make improvements where you can, but be patient and tolerant with the rest of them, because they will disappoint you unless you kind of lower your expectations a little bit about what individuals can contribute. My father reinforced that same message, by the way. He used to have a saying, not to be disrespectful to anybody, but he used to say, "Son, with these oxen, you must till." You're not going to have the choice of selecting the top oxen. You've got to till with what you've got.
That's a great lesson. So let's then focus on that point. Then you've now become CEO of this spinoff, and now you're taking it public. What happens then? What was that like?
That was one of the most intense experiences of my entire life. So what happens is, and most people that have gone through an IPO or understand the initial public offering process, first of all, technically it was a reverse merger. Parent company, me in charge of the subsidiary. The subsidiary was going to reverse merge and become the entity that was going to go public, and the parent company was going to go away. So we prepared. Obviously, preparing for an IPO means preparing all kinds of paperwork for the SEC, prospectus, things for the investors. And then the CEO and my CTO and my CFO, we hit the road for a 2-week roadshow. Every single day, we would call on 6 to 8 to sometimes 10 investors, analysts, hedge fund directors. Sometimes it was a one-on-one meeting or one-on-three meeting. Sometimes it was a whole room full of people. And you repeated the same story time after time where you could recite it in your sleep. So what would happen is the companies that we used to take us public, Credit Suisse, First Boston, and Merrill Lynch, and two others. So Merrill Lynch was running most of the logistics on the ground. We would arrive at a city. They would bring a limo to pick us up at the hotel. The limo would drop us off at the first appointment, get in the elevator, ride to the suite we were going to present in, present 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes tops, come back down, jump in the limousine, go to the next one, wash, rinse, repeat. Next town, same thing. Boston, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco. You know, it was like nonstop for 2 weeks. I was exhausted at the end of 2 weeks. But then that culminated in the day we went public, showing up in the New York Stock Exchange, ringing the bell, going down to the floor and buying the first 100 shares of my newly publicly traded New York Stock Exchange company, which I named. I picked the stock symbol. I hired the people. It was like, you know, a baby being born, right? And then from then on, it was just a roller coaster ride, a mad roller coaster ride. And so it was very exciting, right? Very heady and just like super, super exciting stuff. You know, people giving you all these accolades and heaping all these great compliments on you, which is great. But at the same time, in the back of my head, a little voice is saying, "You have no idea what you're doing. You've never done this before. You're asked to make decisions you've never seen before." You know, yeah. It was scary.
So there had to be at that point, though, Enrique, a lot of pride in your family. I mean, your parents had to be thrilled, right?
Oh, they were. You know, you could see it in their face. They didn't have to say it. They were so proud. And by the way, the flip side of that is how much I disappointed them once we get to that part of the story. But, oh, they were extremely proud. And then the rest of my family as well, you know, because my cousins had all grown up in this country, educated in this country. So they totally understood the way America does business and the way corporations are set up. My parents probably didn't understand a lot of that. My dad a little bit more, because he had actually gotten to the point of, even with a sixth grade education, becoming plant superintendent at a shoe factory, leading, you know, a couple of shifts of blue collar workers, and doing an excellent job. He taught me so many leadership examples. Biggest lesson he told me, he said, "Son, if you're going to be dumb, you better be tough." What he meant was, if you don't have the skills for something and haven't bothered to go get them, you're going to have to face the consequences. So you better toughen up. But anyway, extremely proud. They were extremely proud of their son. It was just an immense feeling of fulfillment for me to be able to see the joy in my mother and my father's eyes, that all the hard work that they had put in, in raising us and in sharing with us life's values and principles, had come to this. It was just wonderful.
So, and that in itself is a remarkable thing. So you're literally at the top of the business world, and you know it's a place that so few people ever make, much less a six-year-old Cuban boy, right? You know, coming here with nothing and reaching that is an incredible thing. Tell us then, what happened after that? You know, kind of the short story on that was the rise, and then there's a fall, right?
Yeah, dramatic rise and an equally dramatic fall. And I guess at the same time, if you recall back in that period of time, this is like just before 9/11, and then 9/11 happened, and you know, all kinds of bad things started happening. But we had been having difficulty because the underpinnings of the company that I had started were based on the principles from the parent company, which had a lot of kind of negative issues associated with it in terms of how they recognized revenue, in terms of some of their business practices. And the team that I put together was trying to eradicate that. But at the same time, the parent company, which had become now an advisory company, no longer a public company, was still advising us. And I was being mentored by some of these people, including the ex-CEO. And I was getting some bad advice. And now, let me point out to you that I'm not blaming the bad advice. The blame was with me, because I was accountable as CEO. And as CEO, you make the final call on anything you do, whether it's a marketing strategy, a product strategy, a big deal that you're trying to close and how you're going to price it and the terms and conditions of those deals, you know, mergers, acquisitions, all that stuff, investments, our technology portfolio, our patent portfolio. You know, all those things are, at the end of the day, the decision of the CEO. So as we started to run into some difficulties and we saw that the quarterly goals were more difficult and more difficult to attain, we started pulling what I call just insane feats of you know, negotiations. And we would send executives out to make investments at in the universities where these decision makers went to school in an effort to get on their good side. We were using cash to try and buy our way into some deals. None of that is illegal, by the way, none of it. It's questionable from a long-term sustainability standpoint, that I got to tell you, and I learned that quickly, but none of it illegal. But then we started to get into some gray areas in the decision-making in terms of our deals, our partnerships with integrators, systems integrators, and distributors. And here's what happens. When you start going into the gray area, sometimes you don't know and lose sight of the fact that you slipped into the black. It's no longer gray. It's a slippery slope. That's what happened. We made some bad decisions. I made some bad decisions. I made some bad deals. We made some bad deals. And we broke the law. And so what happened was we had a couple of situations where one, a whistleblower in one of our field offices called the SEC and said, hey, these deals are not right. So the SEC told us that they were starting an investigation. And then at the same time, we had a problem in one of our regions where the auditors found two versions of a contract with two different types of terms and conditions, the external auditors. So all of a sudden, I found myself in a situation where I was way in over my head. I started to talk to some of my members of the board, whom I had asked to come on board, started to talk to my management team, quickly discovered that I was actually going to be in trouble because of some of the decisions that I had made. At the same time, I got a Wells letter from the SEC, and a Wells letter, for those that are familiar with SEC practices, puts a big target on your back. It basically tells you that you are the target of an investigation. So, you know, I spoke to my own personal attorneys and I said, listen, I have so much pressure on me and I have this burden that I'm carrying that I've done something wrong. I have no desire to fight it. I think I need to come forward and take my lumps. And so my attorneys said, basically, well, you know, chances are you're still going to be sentenced to serve time, but it'll be considerably less time than if you go to trial and you lose. And, you know, I had two young children and you know, and I'm thinking, what am I going to tell my parents and how are they going to react and my family? And, you know, but at the end of the day, what drove me was wanting to do the right thing. I had let the shareholders down because, you know, the stock price plummeted once some of this stuff became public, right? I had let the shareholders down, my employees down, my colleagues, my board of directors, most of which I had appointed, some pretty big names too. You know, people that had served in the Clinton cabinet and people that were members of boards of very large companies that they had taken a chance on me and joining our board, you know, and a green CEO with absolutely no experience whatsoever. But I just wanted to make it right. I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't live with myself because I had violated my core values and principles that my parents had instilled in me. And so we went in, we talked to the Department of Justice and to the SEC, and I said, I want to plead guilty. And so that's what I did. And it was a long and arduous process, very painful. Let me tell you, there's nothing worse than getting up every single morning and the first thing that pops into your head is, this is hanging over my head. This is on my shoulders. Once I decided to take the plea, that weight came off the shoulders. Now, there was other stuff that was going to happen that I had no idea, right? Who can anticipate? You can look it up. You can research what's going to happen. But until it happens, you actually don't know. And so that whole process culminated in me standing in front of the judge. And it was roughly a week before Thanksgiving in 2007. And the courtroom was very sparse. There was hardly anybody in the courtroom. My wife was in the back. I knew that she was in the back, but obviously she was behind me. And so I had to stand up and allocute. I had to tell the judge, you know, what I had done and, you know, my remorse and all that. I had over 60 letters written on my behalf from all kinds of people, employees, friends, relatives, colleagues, all asking the judge to be lenient with me. But the judges are used to that. That's not going to sway a judge. So he had me stand up, and then after I allocated, he said, you know, by the way, my lawyer had asked for leniency, and the prosecutor had said, Mr. Fiallo has shown remorse. He stepped up. He has pled guilty. He has realized all the things he's done. He's assisted the government in sifting through all of this mess. And he recommended 3 years. My deal was 5 years, tops. He recommended 3 years, which put a lump in my throat, 3 years in jail. The judge said, I don't really think that coming off of the five-year cap makes any sense here. He says, but against my better judgment, because this is not only a sentence to punish Mr. Fiallo for what he's done, but it's also meant to send a message as a deterrent to others, which, by the way, makes no sense because there's no such – I mean, people have been breaking these laws for years and continue to break them. But anyway, he said, I sentence you to 48 months in a federal penitentiary, 200 hours of community service, and whatever restitution the SEC and the Department of Justice feel that you owe. And that was it. I mean, he said, report to prison. At least he let me choose the prison I was going to serve most of my time in. He said, you'll self-surrender on January 4th, 2008. And he let me go on my own recognizance, and my wife and I staggered out of that courtroom. I don't even remember what happened over the next several days. My mind was in such a fog. So that was the fall. You know, dramatic rise, everything great, but then a huge crash and burn as I faced the next 4 years in a federal prison.
That's a tough situation, no doubt. At that point, you know, let me ask you this, that, you know, a lot of people, if they do reach that pinnacle of career success or, you know, in whatever career they have, many of them lose whatever humility they once ever had, and they believe their own press, that they are the answer to everything, that they are sort of their, you know, in the business world. I mean, Simon and I encountered all the time that people believe in a way that they are their title, right? They are what they do. But when you reach that level of CEO of a public company, you've rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange, that abrupt fall from that stature to now you're a convicted felon. Now you have no job. Now you've let everybody down, and now you're going to prison. What do you take from that? Was there a point when you were defensive or did you accept what you'd done and you're like, I need to change?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it have been something else if I had become defensive and in denial? And well, you're absolutely right about the pride and the ego, because that can consume you. And what does that do? It creates blind spots, right? And the blind spots are things you don't see, you don't understand. In some cases, you may not have the ability to understand because you don't have those skills, you don't have those experiences. And that's what had happened to me. Partly is I was believing my own press. I was taught how to spin by a public relations firm. I could literally walk circles around most Wall Street analysts. I was told, you know more than they do, and don't ever forget that. And so it, instead of becoming humble, which is what I should have done, I became prideful and egotistical. But that day in front of the judge brought me to my knees and brought me to a level of humility that I had not experienced in decades. Because remember, my rise was pretty exponential, and very little humility involved in that entire process. But to me, there are three characteristics of leaders that are most important. Humility is number one. Number two is integrity. And number three is accountability, because we're all going to make mistakes. We just need to understand how to deal with the mistakes. No, nobody's perfect. No human being's perfect. We're imperfect. And so how you deal with mistakes is just as important as trying to prevent them, because you're not going to be able to prevent all of them. Humility helps because it allows you to listen to others. And as a CEO and a leader, if you haven't learned the art of listening, to the right people, by the way, because you could surround yourself with people who are giving you the bad advice. And so, by the way, as part of my stay in prison, and I served 3.5 years of the 48 months, I developed a sense, because I spoke to all kinds of people while in prison. I took a road trip as a guest of the Bureau of Prisons, moving from prison to prison until I ended up back at the Miami camp. And I got to talk to hundreds and hundreds of fellow inmates, some of which were ex-CEOs, ex-CFOs, attorneys, doctors, politicians, bank robbers, drug dealers, you know, head of a biker gang. And I got to ask them, you know, how they made decisions and why they were in prison. A lot of them were still in denial. I didn't break any laws. The government set me up, this and that. But when you work through that facade and you started to get to the real reasons that had put them there, it was blinding flash of the obvious, bad decisions. How did they make those decisions? Most of them did not have a framework by which to make decisions that would allow them to stay away from the bad ones, identify them, stay away from them, and then only stay with the alternatives that had been good that would have been resulted in good outcomes. No guarantee, but at least a fighting chance that you're making the right decision.
So talk about you that need for a second. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Just let me just stop you there for a second. Tell us then about, you know, you go to prison, you talk to many fellow prisoners, you see these common themes amongst them. Tell us about how that resulted in your development of a decision framework.
Well, so first of all, it became obvious that my decisions had not been based on the values that had been instilled in me as a young man growing up by my family. And so I rediscovered the value of core values as a platform by which to live and by which to make your decisions. And so I also realized that in many cases, some people had the wrong core values. Their core values were, you know, enrich yourself, make as much money as you can, win at all costs. Maybe not stated in those terms, but that's basically what they were. Instead of things like integrity is important, and any decision that violates my personal integrity or the company's integrity, if it's a company, or my family's integrity, if it's a core value that's related to your family, is not a decision you want to make. Treating employees fairly, another core value. In some cases, some of these CEOs, some of these CFOs, some of these people I talked with, for example, I talked with an attorney that had an impeccable reputation until it was discovered he was tapping into client escrow accounts in order to meet some of his obligations. Wow. This is a 70-year-old man. And by the way, he died in prison. He died. I met him and I used to sit with him. He was actually teaching me the Torah because I was very interested in his religion and his culture. But, you know, he got really sick. He was shipped to the Federal Bureau of Prisons medical facility in Butner, North Carolina. And about 3 weeks after he was shipped there, I learned that he had passed away. What a terrible tragedy to die in prison. But anyway, the point is that these people either didn't have core values by which to make decisions and by which to eliminate these gray areas and keep the decisions black and white, or they had them, they just violated them. They violated their own principles. And so I started, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so if that's the case then, I mean, look at the world today and, you know, played out on the world's biggest stage, we see glaring ethical transgressions. We see people that tout morality and yet their behavior is nothing moral. We see this all the time. What do you think is the problem with people like that?
I think in some cases they think they can get away with it. So for example, you take the parents that bribed college officials to get their kids you know, made up stories of their kids and get to get their kids into college. Does anybody think that anything like that is right or proper? Unless you're a moron, excuse the expression, I don't think so. So what were they thinking that they could get away with it? Some people feel entitled, you know? So it's a variety of feelings, some of which maybe it's, I don't know any better, but I doubt that there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, I think, I know it's wrong, but I think I can get away with it. Or, you know, I'm entitled to it because it's I deserve it. I've earned it. Besides a lot of other people. So they justify. They do a lot of things to justify violating principles or their own integrity, their own personal integrity. And, you know, when the judge told me he was going to, the deterrent factor was a part of my sentence, I laughed inside. And I keep chuckling about that because, you know, if you're going to break the law, nobody's prison sentence is going to be a deterrent to that. I mean, you look at throughout life, you know, Madoff, the guy from Tyco, the family from Adelphia, the MCI scandal, the Enron scandal, even recently the mayor of Baltimore using her public position and power to self-enrich herself. I mean, if you look at that logically, and you say, okay, here's my core values. They're good core values. I'm going to look at the decision that I'm about to make, look at the core values, see if any of them are violated. Then I'm going to look at the potential outcome of the decision, and I'm going to say, is the potential outcome good or bad? Is there a possibility it could be bad? What's the probability of this being interpreted the wrong way or coming out the wrong way? Now it's more of a very impartial type of decision. Unless you lie to yourself or you kid yourself. And so this is missing in general in today's society. We lack role models. We lack people that act, you know, with integrity, and think about the potential outcomes of their decisions, because decisions have consequences. And if you haven't thought all the way through to the outcome and the consequence, you may be making a bad decision and not know it. I think pride,
Enrique,
and ego,
sorry, just,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Enrique. And it's a really important point, this. And I'm kind of welding together what you've described about you, your energy, your passion, how you built a business and empires, really. And for me, I see, or I reflect on people in things that you've done. And I tend to say they're not lucky. It's fortune, yeah, because you've been brave and courageous. Now, if you look at the opposite of that, from what you've described, you're being honest here and saying it's not being unlucky. It's a misfortune, in my words. And I'm trying to square and my push on it just now, and it's kind of like, how do you get, what's the learning of where we say values and we read them day in, day out, yeah, in every a piece of media, brochures, a company accounts. How do we square this walk the walk bit? Because it's all very well saying that I've got integrity. You know, how do leaders, well, I guess not just leaders, because the whole family of a company and business is all part of it. How do you, you know, what advice do you give on the what I wish I knew here? You know, it's a really important point, and you've been so open to say, look, if you're in a business or you're leading a business in any part of that business, how do you seriously walk the walk? Because the fortune is on you as a business. It's not being unlucky, because being unlucky means that you're trying to get away with it.
Yeah, great question. And by the way, walking the talk is so important as part of this framework. So here's the deal. If you're a leader of a family or a leader of a company or a team or a department or whatever, how can you possibly trust? Because you can't be with everybody constantly involved in every single thing they're doing. So the process is this. You've got to establish these core values. You've got to make sure that they're not just you shouting them down from the top of the mountain, that you've involved a bunch of people in creating them so that they make sense and that they resonate and that they've got widespread adoption. You've got to communicate them. You've got to make sure that they don't become shelfware, i.e. a PowerPoint presentation or a laminated card that somebody stuffs in their drawer. No, they're real. And guess what? Every single business process we have is going to use these core values. That means your interviewing process, your recruiting process, your interviewing process, your hiring process, your orientation and onboarding process, your purchasing processes, your accounting processes, your logistics and packaging and shipment and fulfillment processes, your customer service processes. Every single business process has to focus and be based on this platform of core values. You got to make sure it's widely communicated. The leader and the leader's direct reports have to walk the talk. You can't be espousing integrity and all this stuff and then be making shady deals or entering into partnerships with companies that are have questionable practices. Like, for example, a company that is polluting the environment and you strike a deal with them. So how much integrity do you have? And if you said that you're green and one of your core values is to protect the environment and you enter into a deal with a company that doesn't, you're not walking the talk. So you got to walk the talk, right? You got to do all those things I said before. You got to walk the talk as a leader and leaders direct reports and below. And then if you find any violation of the core values, no tolerance. You got to have a no tolerance policy so that people know that you mean business. And so that's what you need to do to demonstrate that this is serious and it's part of every single business process that you have, your selling process, your marketing processes. You know, having marketing ads and marketing material that are glossy and just a bunch of BS that you don't really meet, that's not integrity. That's not having integrity. That's not relying on a set of realistic and real core values. And so you employees have to, and your family members too, have to know that you believe it. But by the way, one of the things that happened as a young man, and again, I love my father, and I'm telling this story not to criticize my father, but as a demonstration of the difference between having a core value, for example, never tell a lie, or, you know, do your best at not telling lies, because we're not perfect. But here's what happened. One day we're sitting around watching TV, the phone rings. My dad says, answer that. But if it's so-and-so, tell him I'm not home. So as a kid, I answer the phone and it is so-and-so. And I tell him, oh, my dad's not home. I'll have him call you when he gets back. I just lied for my father. So my father showed me an example where it was lying, you know, and he was accepting the lie. So, you know, little minor infraction here, but as a leader, you really have to watch out for that because your followers are watching you to see if you really mean what you say, if you really walk the talk. So important to walk the talk. Anybody can talk, but walking the talk is the difference between a leader with integrity and not.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us. We really appreciate you sharing your story, you know, the highs and the lows and, you know, the pains that come with it. And, you know, it sounds like what you do these days really is share your story in hopes of helping people make better decisions. And that's an inspiring thing for sure.
I think that's what it's all about. I mean, I consider part of my paying back to society was not just doing the time that I did and doing the community hours, but telling this story. And if I can avoid one person from making a mistake without at least having thought about the decision-making process, then I'm accomplishing what I believe I need to accomplish.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics.
If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.